Hi, thanks for joining us this morning. I'm Chrissy Mernon. My guest is Jonathan Ryan. He is the executive director of RYESIS, the Refugee and Immigrant Center for Education and Legal Services. We're going to talk about what's going on with immigration and how RYESIS has been thrust into, I guess, a national role with the immigration debate. So let's start at the beginning, how RYESIS came about. It's a national organization now, but began in San Antonio?
It did. And RYESIS has been here for about 32 years. We were founded in 1986. And it was really born from the sanctuary movement in South Texas in the early 1980s, when people from all over the country were volunteering to work with Central American refugees who were fleeing from the countries of Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala, because of the wars that were raging there. And there were, at that time, policies here in the United States that made it virtually impossible for these people to get asylum. And so people were working with refugees who literally were coming to our country still bearing the physical wounds of the wars that they were suffering there. And people were surrounding them, trying to help them. And, that developed into what became RYESIS here in San Antonio. Many of those volunteers are San Antonio residents. And it began in the mid-80s as really a loose affiliation of individuals and then formalized throughout the late 80s into what is now a legal services organization. But in many ways, we're back to our roots, as our name describes, the RYESIS means roots in Spanish, of working with primarily Central American women and children who themselves are fleeing some of the worst violence on earth. We have to remember, these countries of Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala are the most dangerous places on earth outside of the active war zones in Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan. You have some of the highest rates of femicide, highest rates of child murder in the world. And what they are fleeing is extreme violence. They're fleeing in many directions, not just to the United States. You find that the countries surrounding this area, it's called the Northern Triangle, are themselves seeing multiple 100% increases in the request for asylum there. That includes Nicaragua, Ecuador, Mexico. People are fleeing for their lives. And of course, many people travel to the United States because this is where they have family contacts. And also, let's not forget, this is the land of hope and promise. This is the place that for my lifetime, for more than 70 years, has held itself out around the world as a beacon of hope and liberty for people who are suffering persecution and discrimination. And people follow that promise. And it is enshrined in our laws that people can come to our country, come to the border and request asylum. That is the legal process. That is the only way that you can request asylum. I've heard on the television, people say, well, why don't you go to an embassy in your country and try to get asylum there? Well, the fact is that you can't. There is no apparatus in a U.S. embassy that is set up to receive requests for asylum. Moreover, imagine being in an extremely dangerous place where you are targeted for murder, for assault, for threats, and you walk into the U.S. embassy and request asylum. You're going to have to walk out of that embassy and wait for some kind of process if there was one in place. That essentially marks you as somebody who has already voiced that you are under threat and would put somebody's life at great risk. It would be essentially a suicide mission to go into a U.S. embassy and do that. So what the law says is that you must come to the border and you must request asylum here inside the United States. That's how the process works. And what RYESIS exists to do is to provide people the necessary legal representation that they need in order to navigate what is an extremely complicated landscape of immigration officers and judges and prosecutors that nobody, believe me, nobody could handle by themselves. I went to law school and it still took me years of practice, honestly, to be myself capable of presenting an asylum application to court. How could you imagine that a four-year-old child alone, who's stripped away from their parents, could go into court and actually go up against a government prosecutor, explain to a judge why they can't go back to their home country. These children don't even understand what a court is. We're there to protect them, but we also explain to them what to expect in court. And we tell them about the legal process. We tell them about the evidence that they have to present. But we also have to tell children not to fall asleep in court. We have to tell children not to lick the microphone that's in their face so that they can be heard on the record. It is a bizarre scene, frankly, to step into a courtroom and to see adults in all of the positions of power and a little child sitting in the respondent's chair, her little shoes dangling above the ground, the judge leaning over his bench just to be able to look at her in the eyes. It's something that I don't think most Americans realize goes on. We think about children in the juvenile justice context or children in the child protective context. But in the child protective context, when you think of a child in a shelter who's being cared for by the state, you don't consider, because it doesn't exist, that the child is the subject of a prosecution, that that child has to defend herself. It's something that has no parallel in our state or national system.
So how long has this been going on at the border, or is this new?
This has been going on for decades, quite frankly. And we've seen family separations going back multiple administrations, not just this one. What we've seen here has been a broad imposition of a policy that, instead of separating families based on some kind of a noted concern about child welfare, to a policy that's based on deterrence, and that separated all families that came to the border in order to, as the administration states, send a message to refugees that they should not come here to the United States, which is in absolute contradiction to our laws, to international law that we ourselves formulated and in many cases imposed around the world. And it's also a contradiction to the principles and values that founded our country.
You know, a lot of people seem to have forgotten that, because this is really an ugly debate, isn't it?
It is very ugly. And when you think that our government, in our name, set up a process that actually intended to terrorize people, women and children, to make the conditions at the border and in these detention centers so impossible that it literally breaks people's will from seeking protection that is afforded to them under the law. It's an undermining of the law. It is, in many cases, breaking the law. And again, it is in contradiction and contrast to the images that we've projected around the world for 70 years, things that actually make us strong as a country. It's our adherence to fundamental values like the dignity of human life and the respect for minority and subjugated people that makes us strong, that makes people respect us, and that also gives us heft when we try to call out other state actors, other groups around the world that themselves are breaking the international laws, themselves are committing humanitarian crimes. Every war that I have ever witnessed the United States engage in my lifetime has been based on humanitarian reasons. And if we as a country cannot live up to the principles that we broadcast and impose around the world, how can we expect other countries to do the same? And how can we, with any legitimacy, go to those countries and demand that other nation states and other groups do that if they can just point right back at us to these examples and say, well, you don't do it, so why should we have to?
So you're saying our government's very hypocritical?
At the moment, we are in a state of complete and broad hypocrisy. And unfortunately, these things are very easy to do in the moment. It only took probably a phone call, frankly, from the White House for this policy to be enacted, but we're going to spend decades, if not longer, putting back together the reputation of the United States abroad and here in this country, not to mention the thousands of lives that have been harmed and in some cases broken by this process.
The harm to families.
Absolutely. We spoke with a client of ours named Darlin just last weekend, and she got out from the detention center, was reunited with her child. She was most recently at a detention center in Pearsall, Texas, about an hour south of San Antonio. And because of a mix-up in paperwork, the government was in the process of bringing her daughter to be reunited with her. And they mixed up the paper and told the daughter in the car on the way to see her mother after nearly 2 months of being separated. Oh, we're sorry. We made a mistake. Your mother doesn't want you. Your mother doesn't love you. And they turned that car around and brought that little girl back. Imagine the trauma to a 13-year-old girl who has been separated from her mother, from whom she has never been separated. They sleep in the same bedroom since she is born and has now spent 2 months away from her, not knowing why her mother is not with her. And now a government official is telling her that her mother doesn't love her. That is extremely traumatic. And Darlene expressed to us that she saw major changes in the behavior, in the manner of being of her daughter since they've been together. This is clearly going to cause deep trauma that is going to have lasting psychological effects on many of these, if not all of these children.
Aren't we? I mean, you know, you look at the state, and the state works to keep families together in situations where there's abuse and neglect. I mean, that's what our government does, wants to keep families intact. And here our government is separate. And you're right, that the trauma and the psychological impact is lifelong.
We often call ourselves a country of family values, and we respect motherhood. We know the science. The United States is rich with experts and associations that have all come out and stated on the record that this policy of family separation is deeply harming to individuals, both the parents and the children. It fundamentally undermines that parent-child relationship in the formative moments and months of a child's life. And the ramifications of that separation will play out throughout these children's lifetimes and could very much erode those family structures that we in this country hold up on high as the fundamental building blocks of our society.
So what happened when the policy was implemented? And I'm asking really the outrage, because a lot of people had something to say about this, and they were concerned because they believed it was wrong.
This was something that captivated the nation. I think it had a lot to do with the recordings that made it out of children crying, pleading to speak with their parents. It is critical that there are images and that there are recordings that get out. Because one thing that you find inside of the immigration detention system, including the children's detention system, that the one thing that is contraband to bring in, the one thing that will get you banished forever for bringing into a detention center, is a camera. And how many times have we seen, just in the past 10 years, that a narrative about who are dangerous people. You could speak about black men in the United States. You could speak about people of minority religions, Muslims, in the United States or abroad, that when camera evidence of how they are actually being treated by the government gets out, it is completely different from the narrative that we've been told and exposing of a violence that is being perpetrated against these people. And this is what's really dangerous and insidious, is that as has happened under this administration, when you paint with a broad brush and characterize entire groups of people as dangerous, as threats, what you actually do is you open up the ability for individuals in that group to be themselves victims of violence, because you're essentially broadcasting that nobody cares. You're desensitizing the people against violence perpetrated to this group, which in a sense is a permission slip.
Makes them a target.
It makes them a target, and it makes those people who have control over them, like someone in a private prison, feel the sense of impunity, that nothing is going to happen to them if they treat people with violence, with disrespect. And it's more than impunity, it's an affirmative encouragement. And we've seen that again and again from this administration. We have seen first ladies going back several administrations voice their opposition and shock at this policy. But we have seen not that from this administration. Many people saw, as the current first lady visited one of these shelters, she was actually wearing a jacket that had writing on the back of it that said, "I don't care." That is a shocking message for our country at the highest level to be broadcasting around the world of complacency, of downright disdain for children who are in one of the most insufferable situations and circumstances you can imagine, being literally ripped away from their parents, not knowing if they'll ever see them again. And unfortunately, what we know now, hundreds of these children are still separated, still in detention, and might never see their parents again.
I'll ask you about that, but is that how you took what she was wearing that day? Because was there ever an official explanation for that? Or you were just so stunned?
I think the entire world took a message away from that. We have, not to dwell on this too much, but we have a first lady who everyone knows is very fashion conscious. And this was a jacket that was off the rack, a $35 jacket from a department store, essentially. Everything is controlled at those highest levels. The message is always controlled. Something was at play there. We can only speculate as to why, but clearly, as that flight was in the air, this was being reported around the country and around the world, yet still that jacket was worn. There must be a reason.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you're talking about some kids may never be reunited with their families. So why? What's going on?
Raisis represents hundreds of children who were kept in these detention centers for children here in San Antonio and in Corpus Christi. Many of the children that we see inside of these centers have been separated from their families. And in many cases, about 460 to be precise, the parents have already been deported back to Central America, and the government has no idea where they are now. The children, many of them are so young that they're still not verbal. And if they are, they don't know their parents' full names. They are only asking for mommy and daddy. The children cannot help to identify who their parents are because they don't know them by their full names. They don't know their government ID numbers. Many of these parents, once deported back to Central America, are marked. They are fleeing for their lives just as they were when they tried to get out of there 2, 3, 4 months ago. And so in terms of connecting with their government, connecting with any kind of process or system that can reunite them with their children is in some cases unimaginable. And in the worst of circumstances, it's probably the case that some parents may have been killed because they were fleeing a threat of murder in the first place. And now that they've been returned, those bad actors, be they government or non-governmental groups who the government cannot or will not protect them from, possibly have succeeded in their mission of eliminating them, leaving these children wards of the state, subject to being placed in foster care or even adopted and never seeing their parents again, perhaps, and unfortunately, really heartbreakingly, over the years, forgetting who their parents ever were.
Our guest this morning is Jonathan Ryan. He is the executive director of the Refugee and Immigrant Center for Education and Legal Services, RIASIS, here in San Antonio. And we're talking about what's been going on with the immigration system and the situation at the border. So what has changed since the president, a court order reunification? Or how did it come about? Is that being fixed?
The short answer is no. The government is under court order to reunite families, and we have seen families released in some cases from detention, but as we know through our work, which is inside the detention centers and has been through these processes before, we know that from the beginning there was a strategy to increase what's called family detention. So even though the mandate of the judge that had a deadline of last Thursday was to reunite the children, we have to unpack the government language when we hear these terms like reunite. Many people think that that means to be reunited and released from custody. But in fact, the strategy of the government is to contract with private prison companies that build bigger detention centers that are intended to house parents and children in prison together. Our organization works in a city called Karn City, just about an hour south from San Antonio, where there is a private prison that used to be a prison for men that was converted into a so-called family detention center. And this is where mothers with children traditionally are held together in a prison-like environment. In the past several days, we have seen an increasing number, about 200 to 300 family units being so-called reunited into these private prisons where the government intends to hold them potentially indefinitely and still try to seek to deport them back to their home country.
So is the, you think the intention is, okay, we're following the judge's order, but we're going to hold you until somebody breaks and you just say, I want to go back to my home country?
That's exactly right. They have every control over the lives of these families and every ability to make every day as hard as possible, from the overpriced telephone calls, from the commissary that sells the only decent food in the entire establishment at inflated prices. People's lives are being ruined while companies are in there profiting off of their distress, off of their misery. There is a boondoggle industry of private companies that contract with the government, be it the private prisons or the companies that do food service or telephone calls or process monetary payments inside of these facilities, that bilk people out of the few remaining dollars that they have left, which essentially leaves them penniless once they do get out, or if they have to try to get a lawyer, they simply don't have those funds anymore. And if you think about it, the fact of holding mothers with their children inside of a prison is itself an unspeakable, unimaginable wrong. The same associations of psychologists, of child development, of family welfare that have blasted the policy of family separation have also criticized family detention. But what the government did, I think it's called gaslighting these days, is that they created a situation that was so horrific with these images of family separation that they could actually implement family detention as a policy that appears on balance to be better, whereas it in fact is just as insidious, just as violent and damaging to these women and children who are often the main victims of our immigration policies, that it appears to be a more acceptable and palatable solution, whereas we know from our work inside that family detention also destructs and erodes the sanctity of the family unit. You essentially have a parent and a child who are both inmates together inside of this prison, both being told to go over here and go over there by prison guards. A parent is there before her child with literally no ability to control that child's food, education, recreation, medical services, and the child sees that. The child sees that the parent has been essentially rendered incapable of exercising that parental authority, which will affect that relationship for many years after they get out from that situation.
So who's advocating for them now in detention?
Our organization, Raisis, is inside of these detention centers every day. We are first and foremost a legal service organization that focuses on refugees who are in detention. That's what we've been doing for the 10 years that I've been with the organization and really the 32 years that they have been active. So we're there every day. We've got attorneys who are probably arriving to the detention center early this morning, and they won't leave until late tonight, visiting dozens of families, just trying to help them to overcome the preliminary interview process that they have to pass to avoid being summarily deported back to their countries without ever having the opportunity to present their asylum claims before a judge and get a proper adjudication of their request for protection.
How long does that process take? How long are they going to be in detention?
It could be weeks, it could be months, it could be much longer. The first step in the process when someone is apprehended at the border, if they present themselves at the port of entry, or if they're apprehended just inside of the country, they actually receive a deportation order up front. They have to request fear. They have to express that they have fear of returning to their home country, which then begins a process called the credible fear interview process, where they go through a brief interview. It could be on the telephone, where they have to express in the space of maybe a half an hour or an hour all of the very worst things that have ever happened to them in their lives. And if you think about that, being in a room on a telephone or with a government official, and you're only hours away from being separated from your child, what kind of mental capacity do you have to really gather your thoughts and explain to them the worst things that have ever happened to you. Or imagine a mother being in a room with her 16-year-old son and having to explain to a stranger in front of her son that she was raped by her husband, potentially that son's father, or by other individuals. She's not going to be able to express the full extent of things that she has suffered because her child may not even know that. She may not feel that her child is capable of hearing the things that have happened to her, or that she knows threats that exist against her child, that she's trying to protect her child from, not just the physical violence that's being threatened, but really the shock and fear of learning that there are people out there who want to do harm to her child. Having to open up to a stranger in a cinder block room inside of a detention center is really not due process. That is not a fair process. It has no integrity, but that's what people have to go through just to be able to get to immigration court. I often say to people that the worst day in the life of someone who lives inside the United States who is undocumented, and every one of your listeners knows somebody, cares for somebody, employs somebody who lives in that circumstance. We all are part of that community.
Or has benefited from their labor.
Absolutely. And many people fear or talk about the fear of being pulled over for a busted taillight and the police call immigration and immigration comes and picks them up and brings them into detention and throws them into deportation proceedings. That is what we often consider the worst day in the life of an undocumented worker in the United States. The fact is that for these women and children who are refugees, who are fleeing the worst violence on earth, we're actually fighting tooth and nail just to get them to that position, just to get them eligible to speak to an immigration judge and truly have their case for protection heard.
So it's really stacked against them, but you're working to overcome that.
The deck is stacked in unimaginable ways against these people. Our work is to try to even that balance, to provide people a chance at fundamental fairness and access to justice. We represent the Constitution. We represent the laws that were put into place in this country by this generation that we call the greatest generation. It was that generation of people that in World War II, as I learned it in school, went to war not to advance our interests, not to protect our borders, but to preserve our fundamental principles as Americans, that people or groups of people shall not be victim of mass murder, persecution, or threat simply because of who they are. It was our grandparents and great-grandparents' generation, who we honor since that date, who went to war, who put their lives on the line and lost their lives to protect those principles. The first thing they did when they came back to the United States is that they implemented a shrine in our laws that commemorated this principle. And that is the refugee and immigration law that I, as an attorney, am so proud to practice today. It is the living legacy in our country of that greatest generation. And what is happening today is a complete and utter disrespect for what the work, the sacrifice that they made, for the laws that they put on the books. It's as if we have justice, we have due process, but we're building this obstacle course around it so that though we can say it exists on the books, they're also preventing the very people who need it from accessing it.
We're out of time. How can people learn more from you, help you, find out about the law?
People can find us at our website, which is RaicesTexas.org. That's a difficult one. It's RaicesTexas.org. And that one word, Raices, Texas, is also our Twitter handle. That's our Facebook name. You can find us on Instagram and all social media platforms under that single word, Raices, Texas. You can donate. That is the number one way to support our work. You can also volunteer for us. We need Spanish speakers. We need people who speak indigenous languages because more of the people who are coming to this country requesting asylum are actually from indigenous cultures inside Guatemala. They don't even speak Spanish. They are extremely disadvantaged in our justice system. And we're appealing to people around the country for their support and their help. We were the beneficiaries of a massive fundraiser on Facebook, but we're also aware that our government is spending many times that every day in order to terrorize these people. And our work is going to continue for many years forward because of what's happened here and what our government may do in the future. We need the support of the people. We need to hear their voice. We need to have change on this issue, and that starts with the people.
Jonathan Ryan, the Executive Director of RYASIS, thank you.
Thank you.